From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, the 2020 presidential field lost someone who loomed large in the early going. Senator Elizabeth Warren dropped out, saying young girls will have to wait another 4 years. She was asked if she's endorsing Biden or Sanders.
Not today. I need some space around this and want to take a little time to think a little more.
Well, meanwhile, those two top remaining candidates are training their fire on each other. Let's get right to it with NPR political reporter Juana Summers. And Juana, what struck you about what Warren said today?
Yeah, so the biggest thing that struck me is that her comments were political, but they were also very personal. She talked about those pinky promises that she'd been making to little girls on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. And she also got a question about the impact of gender on this race. Of the major candidates who started out this race, Elizabeth Warren is the final woman to depart the campaign. And she talked about the fact that when she's asked about gender, it's a trap question. If you acknowledge the sexism in the race, people say you're weak. If you don't, women say, what planet are you on? And she indicated that's a topic she's going to have a lot more to say about in the future. And I think it's something a lot of people want to hear her and the other women who have left this race address.
Yeah. And what are the stakes for her now with people anticipating an endorsement?
I think a lot of people want to hear what she has to say. She indicated that it had been her vision from the outset that while people said this was a race between two competing wings, the more moderate Joe Biden wing of the party and the more progressive space with Bernie Sanders on the left, she felt like there was another path. And evidently, she said she was mistaken now that she's out of the race. So a lot of people want to know. I think they'll be looking to her to see what she does next, if she does indeed endorse. I think it could be a pretty striking statement and could mean a lot as this race is still very, very close and we've got months to go.
Well, people will be, taking apart, dissecting her campaign in the coming days. And we have a story at herenow.org about how women were viewed in this race people might be interested in. But meanwhile, this morning, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer endorsed Joe Biden ahead of that state's primary on Tuesday. And on NBC's Today Show, Joe Biden, who won 10 of 14 states on Super Tuesday, that huge day for him, laughed off Bernie Sanders' claim that he, Biden, is the candidate of the corporate establishment.
It's ridiculous. Bernie, you got beaten by overwhelming support I have in the African-American community, Bernie. You got beaten because of suburban women, Bernie. You got beaten because of middle-class, hardworking folks out there, Bernie.
Well, but Biden is also going to face fire, as you know, from Senate Republicans preparing to vote soon on a subpoena for information on his son, Hunter Biden, and Hunter's former job at that Ukrainian energy company. Now, most analysts concluded that Biden himself rooted out corruption in Ukraine, but is this going to be a problem he's got to face?
Well, it's clear that Republicans want to make it a problem for them, and that's why you see them who are preparing to have the vote on the subpoena that you just mentioned. The question is how much it matters to voters. When I've been out on the campaign trail and I've covered former Vice President Biden, as well as Bernie Sanders and other candidates, this isn't something that often comes up, but it is certainly something that Republicans and I think President Trump will be talking about and hoping that can penetrate and dent support for Biden.
Well, meanwhile, last night, Bernie Sanders spoke to Rachel Maddow on MSNBC and said, if Joe Biden enters the Democratic convention this summer with a plurality of delegates, in other words, more than anyone else, instead of the 1991, the majority that it takes to clinch the nomination, Sanders says Biden would be the nominee. But he said if there's no nominee after the first ballot, superdelegates, those on the sidelines, would then be able to vote. That could be a problem. He said this.
And what I have said is that I think it would be a real, real disaster for the Democratic Party if, you know, I'm running against you and you have more votes than me. And I say, well, wait a second, I don't want Rachel. I want somebody else who didn't get as many votes as she did. Let's have the superdelegates vote on the second ballot. Do you know what that would do to the Democratic electorate? People would say the person who got the most votes didn't get selected.
Most delegates.
Yeah. So parse that for us.
Yeah, so I think there is still a looming threat of a convention fight. We've heard Bernie Sanders argue that whoever gets the most delegates should be crowned the nominee for president. But a lot of lawmakers that I've talked to here in Washington think that the party needs to stick with the rules that were rewritten. They say specifically to address the complaints against bias of Bernie Sanders in his 2016 campaign. I think that there is growing concern among elite Democrats, certainly, that the party needs to coalesce around whoever the nominee is or risk some of the tensions that we saw in the last campaign.
Yeah. Meanwhile, two swing state primaries coming up. We mentioned Michigan Tuesday, Florida the following week. We will be watching with you. Juana Summers, NPR political reporter. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, let's turn now to the coronavirus. Today, a cruise ship is sitting off San Francisco after a passenger who had been on board died of COVID-19 after going home. A state of emergency has been declared in California. There are now nearly 24 cases in New York State and one being reported for the first time in South Africa. Meanwhile, conferences and gatherings are being canceled left and right. Miami's popular electronic dance music event, the Ultra Music Festival, which draws more than 100,000 people, is now effectively canceled for this year. For more on that, we're joined by Miami Herald reporter Joey Fletches. Joey, this is a three-day festival. They're saying it's postponed, but isn't it effectively canceled?
It is. The city has made a decision after meeting with Ultra organizers Wednesday that they want to postpone the event. It will certainly not be happening in March of this year. A commissioner confirmed that on the record, saying that the postponement was decided after this meeting as a result of fears over the spread of coronavirus. And our sources are telling us that right now the city and Ultra are hammering out the legal details of a postponement that would be a year long, and that would effectively cancel this year's event.
And most people have probably already booked flights and hotels. What's the reaction been? Are people calling this an overreaction?
Some people are definitely calling it an overreaction. They're pointing to other large events or even large gatherings in Florida, a tourism-driven economy. They're saying, well, people are still flooding into the area for spring break. You know, why is Ultra being singled out? And, you know, to their point, actually local officials are already talking about another large scale event down here. It's a carnival on Calle Ocho in Little Havana, which could possibly face the same fate.
That is Miami Herald reporter Joey Fletches. Joey, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
And it's not just the Ultra Music Festival. Many other events have been canceled too, including the Geneva International Motor Show, which was supposed to open today, and Facebook's Global Marketing Summit next Monday in San Francisco. We're joined now by James Rooney, who is the former head of the Boston Convention Center, now runs the Chamber of Commerce. James, welcome to Here and Now.
Nice to be here.
Well, and give us a sense of the impact of a canceled conference. How big a deal is it?
Well, it can be, depending upon the size of the conference. It's millions of dollars to local destinations in terms of hotel stays, eating in restaurants. But to the host facility, it's also hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. And then to the event itself, there's a lot of economic activity within the convention or within the industry that is the focus that will be or could be lost.
In normal times, when there's not a coronavirus, how often does an entire conference get canceled?
Oh, almost never. A lot of conventions, because of the spaces they want to be in, will book a city or a convention center 5-7 years in advance.
So, wow.
A lot of this is already pre-planned well into the future, and sometimes a weather event might stop a convention or have an impact on a convention. Unfortunately, there's over the past couple of decades, there's been terrorist activity that has affected meetings and convention activity, but cancellations are very rare.
And in a convention center like the Boston Convention Center, which you ran, is there pretty much always a convention going on?
Yeah, there's cycles, times of the year in the convention industry. Spring and fall are the peak periods. So we are just beginning a peak period, not just in Boston, but in the U.S. market in particular for convention activity. But generally speaking, the rule of thumb is that from a scheduling perspective, a convention center is full about 65% of the year.
Huh. And we're seeing an increasing number of big name companies like Facebook, Mashable, TikTok, and Adobe pulling out of conferences. Are you expecting, as you watch this situation, that we're going to see more and more companies cancel their conferences as the threat of the virus grows?
Yeah, I think that companies, not just in terms of participating in convention activity, we've seen some companies that are members of our chamber who initially limited travel to some Asian countries. The next step was travel international generally was limited. I think it will keep going until this sense of uncertainty and fear begins to abate. Because, you know, businesses don't want to be part of the problem. So I think their view is that, you know, passing on 1 year is not the end of the world for them.
So what do you think it's going to take to give people the confidence to start moving around and attending conferences and conventions again?
Well, I think the beginning of solid information related to data in terms of the behavior of the virus. The test kit distribution would help so that people sort of know what the status of things are. I think greater certainty in terms of control of this problem, that it's unlikely to take off the way it did in China and some Asian countries. When that assurance is given, then I think that people will begin to feel more comfortable.
That is James Rooney, who is the former head of the Boston Convention Center, now runs the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. James, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Wouldn't it be great if we could just take a break from the news? Maybe in the next coronavirus briefing, officials could break into song. In the next political debate, a chorus line. That's what would happen if life was like the new NBC show Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, where Zoe, a computer coder in a high-rolling tech firm, has an accident in an MRI machine, hey, it could happen, and starts seeing everyone's thoughts in song. Workers moving like zombies through the streets suddenly erupt. And then there's Zoe's neighbor, the gender-fluid, always positive Mo, played by Alex Newell. Zoe hears his inner thoughts and realizes all is not what it seems.
Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender, pretending that I'm doing well.
Even Zoe's dad, Mitch, who has a mysterious neurological condition that has left him mute, will have his musical say. Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist had a unique launch. NBC streamed the first episode back in January, then had its broadcast debut a month later on Sunday nights. Joining us, the show's creator, Austin Winsberg. Welcome.
Hi.
And Jane Levy, who stars as Zoe. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to talk to you. I know this is a lot of work to do this many musical performances within a show, but how much fun is this?
It is so much fun. I don't know about you, but I have never heard anybody talk about their experience after dancing really hard and saying it was not fun.
Right.
It's a very different set than a normal set. You look around and the ADs are dancing behind the monitors and the sound guys are bopping up and down. Like, it's fun.
It is so much fun to watch. But Austin, it comes from a painful place. And I just want to stay there for a second because, as I mentioned, Jane's character, Zoe's father, played by Peter Gallagher, has a terrible neurological disorder. He sits mute most of the time. Your father also had a neurological condition?
Correct. Yes, he had something called progressive supranuclear palsy, which we actually name in the second episode of the show. Hmm. And he had this debilitating neurological progressive disease where he, in the matter of less than a year, he went from being this very dynamic, vibrant, social 67-year-old man to a man who was basically imprisoned in his body. And the only thing that he could move was his right arm and his finger and blink. And we knew that he was still processing stuff. We just didn't know how much he was processing. And sometimes it was hard to tell how much of him was there.
Is this kind of wishful thinking on your part? What would have happened if he could have burst into song?
Yes, 100%. That time when my dad was dying, I was becoming a father while losing my dad, and it was such a dramatic, tension-filled, emotional time in my family, and I always liked to draw from my own experiences for my writing, and I knew at some point I wanted to write about what that was, and it was just about getting enough distance from it and trying to figure out what that could be. And one day I just had this idea in my head that what if the way my dad saw the world during that time was through big musical numbers? Mm-hmm. And instead of that being sad and depressing, it actually gave me some sort of feeling of joy and hope. And to be able to connect with my dad in that way felt uplifting to me. So absolutely a big component of this is the wish fulfillment and the what if and what it would be like to actually know what he was thinking and feeling during that time.
Well, you know, amidst all the wackiness of some of the scenes that come from people bursting into song, there are many poignant moments. And one is when Mitch, again played by Peter Gallagher, who is Jane's character Zoe's father, when he does get up and start singing a version of Cyndi Lauper's True Colors. Let's listen.
In a world full of people, you can lose sight of it all, and the darkness inside you can make you feel so small. But I see your true colors shining through. I see your true colors, and that's why I love you.
So, Austin, that means so much more. It was poignant in the moment, but it means so much more knowing that that would have been your hope for your dad.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, for him to communicate and for him to be a guiding light for me during that time and give me guidance. And I think that's how he functions for Zoe during this time.
Yeah.
I think what is so poignant about that scene and about Austin writing from such a personal place is that it becomes so universal. Like, we as humans all know what yearning for parental love feels like, or yearning for our parents to see us, you know. I think watching that scene is so cathartic in that way. I've heard from so many people on the internet and people in my own life about how much that scene affected them, because Austin writes from such a beautiful personal place. It becomes personal for all of us.
Well, you're not just listening. You're not just an observer. There's one scene, I think it's a dream sequence, when you lead the entire office out into the streets while you sing and dance to I Got the Music in Me. Let's just listen to a little of that. Again, a scene from Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. But Austin Winsberg, more
yes.
Jane Levy singing and dancing, please.
Well, funny that you should say that. we actually have an episode of the show coming up where, do we tell this?
I think we tell.
Oh,
I
tell.
Mean, where Jane sings and dances every single song in the episode. And Jane is such, I mean, just to talk about Jane for 5 seconds and embarrass her, Jane tells so much in her face, and she's a master of a million emotions, and you understand them just by looking at her. And so she really does become this amazing conduit, an emotional conduit, where you just understand what she is feeling anytime she sees one of these songs. And then in episode 8 that's coming up, I mean, Jane went to musical boot camp, and we didn't have much time to do it, and she just... it's such a tour de force. It's amazing.
Well, but there's a genre here that you're tapping into, and I'm assuming you're both going to be way too young to even remember the 1990 TV show Cop Rock.
Play it tough, but play it straight, and let's be careful out there.
I know it.
Well, Steve Bochco, the late, great Stephen Bochco, and director Greg Hoblit, and full disclosure, a couple of my siblings would be in and out of the show, so I do have an affection for it, but it was panned. What do you think about the history of this genre? Austin, you start.
My musical philosophy and my TV musical philosophy is, as long as the music is justified, as long as you understand why the people are singing, I think Cop Rock, a show I didn't know very well, but maybe I saw an episode of two or two of back in the day, it was mixing genres. It was trying to do a cop show and a musical show at the same time, and I think those genres maybe were fighting each other.
No. Well, because I loved Cop Rock, I wanted you to say, you know, Cop Rock should have been given more props.
Okay, well, let me say this. Having not seen enough Cop Rock, I think it was ahead of its time.
There.
And I do think that a musical show, there's a lot of challenges doing a musical every week on television. But if you can figure out a way to do it where it connects with an audience, I think music connects with audiences in a way that nothing else can. And I think that music is also universal. So as challenging and as bumpy as the road to musical shows on network TV have been in the past, I do think that when it does work, it can get the audience to relate on a much deeper emotional level than sometimes just dialogue or scene work can. And that's why I'm always drawn to musicals, is the different emotions it can bring out in people in the audience. Yeah.
Well, and that's something that Glee, the phenomenally successful show, discovered. Let's hear a little more of your show, Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. This is a scene in which Zoe's best friend at work, Max, played by Skylar Astin, suddenly bursts out into "I think I love you," so she has to see his innermost thought right in the middle of the workplace. Let's listen. This is a big roll of the dice by NBC. As we said, they had this marketing effort to get to younger people through streaming, and did get to millions of them before they actually debuted on broadcast TV. It's on your shoulders, and they are tiny, petite shoulders. how stressful? I mean, you know, I don't want to add to it, but how stressful is that?
Really, extremely so stressful.
Yeah.
I am someone who has very high standards for myself and puts a lot of pressure on myself to begin with. So then when real pressure is put on you, it's hard, but I'm learning and I feel really grateful. It's rare as an actor that you get a job. Well, one, it's rare to get a job. And then it's rare to get a job that just speaks so closely to your humor, your sentiments, your taste. And like, I just feel this job is so special and I feel like it was meant for me. And so I'm going to work as hard as I can to uphold this young woman.
And I feel a responsibility to Jane, because I feel like Jane and I both have very high bars and very high standards. And I feel like in the writing of Zoe, it maybe started off as like a version of me, and now it's morphed into some version of Austin and Jane. And I know what Jane can do, and so I'm always trying to challenge me and challenge her to go even further with it.
Yeah. As you, again, you pay tribute to your late dad.
Yeah.
That's Austin Winsberg, creator of Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. We've also been speaking with Jane Levy, the star. It airs Sunday nights on NBC. Thank you both, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
It's Here Now.
Microsoft, Amazon, Twitter, and JPMorgan Chase are all encouraging many of their employees to stay home as the coronavirus continues to spread. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, nearly a third of Americans could do their jobs from home, prompting some managers to say that post-COVID-19, the nature of work will probably never be the same. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So we mentioned those tech companies with campuses, for example, in Washington State. They're urging their employees to work from home, especially after some tested positive for COVID-19. JPMorgan Chase is asking 10% of its workforce to stay home in an experiment they're calling Project Kennedy. What's that about?
Well, so what's remarkable to me about all this is that, you know, big banks like J.P. Morgan and other big companies all have what's called business continuity plans that were mostly implemented after the September 11th attacks. And obviously the idea there was that if suddenly you had to evacuate an office, you could regroup in another location elsewhere and there'd be computers and phone lines and whatever else you needed ready to go. This is nothing like that, obviously. So it's something that I think a lot of companies are doing on the fly because for a lot of big companies, the big question is, can their systems handle that many people working at home? Can their VPNs, you know, how an employee would connect remotely? Do they have enough bandwidth to actually handle this? And do the employees themselves actually have the right equipment they have to do their job, especially in a situation where the computer connectivity may be less robust than it is in the office. So when you look at JP Morgan, I mean, this is a huge company with more than 120,000 employees. And I think the reason they're starting with just that 10% is just to see how it works, see what sort of pitfalls they will encounter with the technology and try to work them out before they may need to do it on a broader scale.
Well, certainly there are upsides. I mean, there's less traffic. People aren't going to be stuck in traffic for hours a day, lower rents possibly, easier childcare. Why does it take a virus to make companies think of this as a possibility to let a significant amount of the workforce work from home?
Well, I think, you know, in general, a lot of companies worried that they'd be able to really monitor the productivity of the work being done at home. And they were a little reluctant to allow too much telecommuting because of that. And in banking, you know, to get back to the JP Morgan example, financial industries where people are dealing with huge amounts of money, there's obviously that risk of, you know, some monkey business, for lack of a better word. I mean, that risk is there even when they're working under your roof and you can monitor them closely. So there's sort of a variety of reasons why companies were reluctant to embrace it in big mass numbers. But as you say, I think this situation is going to allow them to sort of reassess that and see how it works. And I do think you're right that there could be a dramatically different approach to it going forward.
There are, of course, a lot of Americans who can't do their jobs remotely, workers in retail, transportation, the restaurant industry. Is there anything, just briefly, that employers can do to help those workers during the outbreak?
I mean, it's a huge economic risk. I think it depends on what sort of company you're talking about, a big corporation or a mom and pop shop. So the smaller you are, I think the less you'll be able to absorb those losses.
That is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Working from work or home, Mike, today?
I'm still at work.
Okay.
For now.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Religious conservatives openly want to overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision legalizing most abortions. But in her new, exhaustively reported book, investigative journalist Catherine Stewart reminds us that opposition is relatively new. In the 1960s, Protestant leader Billy Graham said, "I believe in Planned Parenthood," disagreeing with Catholics who were against abortion. In 1971, the Southern Baptist Convention called for the legalization of abortion to preserve the emotional, mental and physical health of the mother, and the Supreme Court obliged in 1973 with Roe v. Wade. It wasn't until 5 or 6 years later, Stewart writes, that the anti-abortion movement was created to unite Christians, but it was to fight to keep the tax-exempt status of Christian schools. And she quotes leaders saying the abortion fight was also part of a deeper goal to replace democracy with an autocratic theocracy, perhaps led by Donald Trump, based on the lie that a theocracy is what the founders wanted. There's a lot here. Catherine Stewart's book is The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. She's in our studio. Welcome.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
And we should say, you traveled to many of the conferences held by organizers of these movements. They spoke to you directly. You have quoted many of them directly. And still, what I just laid out, you know, people are going to say, that's crazy talk, you know, this kind of conspiracy thing. But then we hear quotes. Evangelical Lance Wallnau, who said, "With Trump in office, we'll have authority in the spirit to build the house of the Lord." Activist Paul Weyrich quoted saying, "Let us remember the religious right didn't come together in response to Roe. What got us going was the attempt on the part of the IRS to rescind the tax-exempt status of Bob Jones University because of its racially discriminatory practices." Briefly remind us about this. The real start of the anti-abortion movement was Bob Jones University?
As Weyrich knew, Jerry Falwell and many of his fellow Southern white conservative pastors were closely involved with segregated schools and universities, and they had come together as a political force out of the fear that their institutions would soon be deprived of their lucrative tax advantages. So remember, Bob Jones University was a segregated institution. In a radio address called "Is Segregation Scriptural?" he declared, "God is the author of segregation."
Well, but then in this move to organize Christians, you and others have said that it was necessary for Protestants and Catholics to join forces. Previously, you know, Protestants had been, they were for the health of the mother, as we just heard.
Indeed. When Roe v. Wade was passed, Betty Ford called it a great, great decision. Barry Goldwater, that great conservative hero, applauded, and his wife, Peggy, co-founded Planned Parenthood in Arizona. But over time, leaders of the movement knew that they needed an issue that was going to unite conservative Catholics and conservative evangelicals. And over time, they settled on abortion because defending the tax advantages of segregated academies really wasn't an issue that was going to seem attractive to the movement.
Well, and you say none of this would have been possible without a well laid out revisionist history laid out by Christian nationalist historians like David Barton and Russus John Rushdoony, R.J. Rushdoony. Let's just get a little context here. In 1980, the religious right movement was now snowballing, the one you just described. Ronald Reagan, who, by the way, is governor of California, passed the most liberal abortion rights law previous to Roe v. Wade, is now running for president. He's speaking at a conservative convention, expressing doubts about, you know, evolution, for instance. You quote an activist, Gary North, saying at that convention, none of us would be here without R.J. Rushdoony. Talk about these strands that you draw a line from to today.
Well, Rushdoony advocated a return to biblical law in America. He said the Bible commands Christians to exercise absolute dominion over the earth and all of its inhabitants. Women are destined to be subordinate to men. Men are destined to be ruled by a spiritual aristocracy of right-thinking Christians. And the federal government is an agent of evil. Public education, in his mind, was a threat to civilization. He laid it all out in a program that he calls Christian Reconstruction. Rushdoony drew his own inspiration from a number of sources. One is the work of America's band of pro-slavery theologians. Another comes from the theologians who labored on pro-capitalist libertarian responses to the New Deal.
So hold up there. You've got pro-slavery Christian theologians who felt that slavery was a direct command from God?
Indeed. The widely influential Presbyterian theologian Robert Louis Dabney cast abolitionism as a hurricane of anti-Christian attack. That's a quote.
Well, and so these are the words that are passed on by R.J. Rushdoony, who has died, but as you know, many told you, and you quote them liberally, inspired the religious right movement that grew in the 1980s. But at this time also, there was a revisionist history about what the Founding Fathers said. Now, we know the country was founded on a separation of church and state, but those words were twisted.
Yes. In Rushdoony's telling, it was not the intention of America's founders to establish a non-sectarian representative democracy. He characterized the American political system as a, quote, development of Christian feudalism. That's what he said. And he said that the First Amendment aimed to establish freedom, quote, not from religion, but for religion. This is a phrase widely parroted by Christian nationalists today.
You met people. You went to the Museum of the Bible, a private museum in Washington, D.C., where you met people, tourists, who expressed to you, wow, I always thought we had separation of church and state, but we don't.
I went to strategy meetings, pastor gatherings, and I heard many activists say, I was always taught a lie that church and state should be separate. But now, after hearing this presentation, I realize that that's not true and that's not what America's founders intended.
You write that you're also hearing leaders of this movement say outright that the Bible is commanding parts of their movement.
You know, Ralph Drollinger, Capital Ministry, he's held Bible study sessions with members of the United States Congress. At least 11 out of 15 members of Trump's cabinet asserts the Bible is in favor of deregulation. Progressive taxes are unbiblical, and he insists that nowhere does God command the institutions of government or commerce to fully support those with genuine needs. When we think of the religious right, we often imagine it as preoccupied with cultural issues such as abortion or same-sex marriage, but its aim is to create a new type of order, one in which Christian nationalist leaders will enjoy positions of exceptional privilege in politics, law, and society. So this movement is a political movement. Its goal is power. When the leaders are speaking to the rank and file, it's all abortion all the time. But when you listen to what they say, when they're in the forums that they share, when they talk to one another, they're advocating for a very wide range of policy positions, economic policy, foreign policy, and domestic policy.
The left has had movements as well, civil rights, women's rights, gay rights. Why is this different?
These movements that you're mentioning respect the Constitution. They respect pluralism. I think most Americans reject the politics of conquest and division that the Christian nationalist movement represents.
This deep dive for you, including your previous book, The Good News Club, started in a personal place. You were in Southern California, 2009, and an older couple from another town wanted to start a Bible club at your children's public school?
That's right. It was really surprising to me that a group that intended to convert very little children to fundamentalist Christianity could even operate in a public school, which is supposed to serve a diverse community. Good news clubs confuse little children into thinking that the religion of the club is endorsed by their school. And I saw how leaders of the club were exploiting their position in the public school to try to persuade kids to recruit their peers to the club and sometimes even target them with faith-based bullying and bigotry. Mm-hmm. Good news clubs were part of a much larger attack on public education, and the attack on public ed was really just one part of a wide-ranging attack on America as a modern constitutional democracy.
Has anyone come forward since the publication of this book and said that's not true?
No one has said that's not true. A couple nights ago, I had a half-hour conversation with Jim Doman, the head of Church United. He knew I was an opposition journalist. He still invited me to one of his events. He said, terrific piece. I thought that was interesting.
Catherine Stewart, her book is The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. Catherine, thank you so much for speaking to us about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
This week in 1865, President Abraham Lincoln stood at the Capitol and delivered his second inaugural address. The words then were pasted on a single large piece of paper. They are now etched inside the Lincoln Memorial. A new book focuses on what Lincoln said, but also on some of the historical figures who were in the crowd that day. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports.
I think this is his greatest speech, and it's a kind of a spooky, strange speech.
Edward Acorn is the author of the new book, Every Drop of Blood, The Momentous Second Inauguration of Abraham Lincoln.
They're on the brink of saving the country from being destroyed. And instead of having this great celebratory speech, he talks about all the suffering that that war engendered was God's just punishment for the sin of slavery.
Randy Duncan, who often portrays Lincoln, reads the president's words from March 4th, 1865.
It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has His own purposes.
In the crowd listening that day, the actor John Wilkes Booth, an ardent supporter of the Southern cause. Acorn says Booth thought Lincoln was a tyrant who had to be removed, and he would kill the president just a few weeks later.
He got a pass into the Capitol building, and he used that pass to slip in behind Lincoln when Lincoln was walking out to the platform, and somebody apprehended him. God knows what would have happened if they hadn't. There's a lot of people who thought Booth wanted to kill Lincoln right on the platform in the way maybe like Brutus killing Caesar at the Senate.
The poet Walt Whitman covered the inauguration for the New York Times.
He wrote more about the setting of the speech, which makes me wonder how well he heard it. But he wrote about a cloud over Lincoln's head like a bird of peace. And he wrote about the sun coming out, and he wrote about being able to see Venus up in the sky. And he thought all these things were quite poetic statements that this suffering was finally coming to an end.
Frederick Douglass, the famous black abolitionist, was also at the Capitol for the inauguration. As Acorn writes, Douglas had disparaged Lincoln as devoid of anti-slavery conviction. But on this day, he heard Lincoln condemn slavery as a grave sin that caused a civil war.
He came to understand that Lincoln was a statesman who had to time his actions to what the public would accept. And I think that's a very poignant thing to see at the end. He's there at the speech, standing out in the mud because they wouldn't let African Americans into the Capitol building for the ceremonies. And then he went to the White House that night, and the guards tried to throw him out because he was African American, and he persisted and got in to the reception. And Lincoln said, "Oh, here's my friend Douglas." And Lincoln was thrilled to see him and asked him what he thought of the speech.
Douglas told Lincoln it was a sacred effort. The response pleased the president, who wasn't religious but had clearly spoken in biblical terms in a speech that ends with these words:
"With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations."
To me, that is a message that we cannot lord it over each other. We cannot be self-righteous. We cannot look at the Southerners as treasonous who deserve to be punished for this. We have to bind up each other's wounds. And that's an extraordinary thing to say, because while he was saying those words, General Sherman was in South Carolina virtually raping the state to force the South to surrender. There were many people who wanted the South to pay a deep price. They wanted Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee strung up and hanged for sedition. And Lincoln had a different approach to that, and I think he had a sane and more pragmatic approach.
And more charitable.
I think the level of horror of that war called for charity at the end of it.
For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Yes, we'll rally round the flag, boy. Rally once again. Shouting the battle cry of freedom.
You can hear the entire second inaugural and read an excerpt of the new book at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
The battle cry of freedom.